This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about a San Luis Obispo housing law that might actually be illegal and may force many college students to live off lease.
This was put in place 30 years ago. Maybe it doesn't seem like a big deal, but for some of these students, it affects them every day in their own homes.
And later, we'll get to know the winner of Cal Poly's first ever Martin Luther King Jr. Legacy Award, a professor who has dedicated her time at Cal Poly to raising awareness for diversity and inclusion at the university.
For me, growing up, coming to college and even graduate school and even as a professor, sometimes it's easy to feel like I'm not as good as somebody else because of internalized feelings around racism or sexism.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It is Monday, March 4th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. A 30-year-old San Luis Obispo city law is causing Cal Poly students to live off lease, and it may be illegal. That's the headline of a recent article from Cal Poly student media outlet Mustang News. Joining me is the student reporter and author of the story, Ashley Layden. Hi, Ashley.
Hi, how's it going?
Going well, thank you. Okay, Ashley, what's going on? What does it mean to be off lease?
Yeah, so living off lease is a pretty common situation for a lot of Cal Poly students and students in general, but it's basically to cut down costs of rent. Students live in homes without landlords knowing, and some of those students are on rent, but then if there's an occupancy limit, they just add more students secretly.
So tell me, how did you find this story? You mentioned off lease being sort of an open secret on campus. Mm-hmm. Do landlords know about it? Break this down for me.
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of students, I'd say probably the majority of students living in homes in SLO live with some students off the lease. But I don't think a lot of students knew about the ordinance, and I wasn't really familiar with it as well. But once an anonymous source actually reached out to me about it and just said I should look into it. And after that, it was really clear that city officials and everyone kind of knew about this and knew that the legality was questionable.
Anonymous source, very cloak and dagger. Okay, so tell us about this ordinance in SLO. What's going on? How does San Luis Obispo do things?
Yeah, so as you said, this is a 30-year-old ordinance, and it limits the number of adult tenants in a typical dwelling or typical home to 5, which is a lot more restrictive than California occupancy laws. And if you want to rent to more than 5 adult tenants in a single home, you have to get this permit, which pretty much no one gets because there's no benefit basically for landlords to get this permit. You have to pay for it, and it's hard to apply for.
Now, break this down. Like, how can this be legal in SLO but not in California?
I mean, when this was first passed, it was legal. It was passed in 1989. But in 1992, there was a court case which basically set precedents in California that city law can't be more restrictive than state law, and it actually dealt with occupancy as well. And then the only caveat is that if you find with actual findings because of your climate or city environment that you need this more restrictive law, then it can be legal. But SLO hasn't done that yet since this 1992 case.
So what does this look like for students living off lease? I'm imagining a bunch of students crammed into a house. You mentioned some students having to hide from their landlord. What are some of the scenes that you saw?
Yeah, so I mean, there's different degrees of off-lease living, because for my article, I really wanted to focus on how in a lot of these situations, like, it can be comfortable for these students to, like, they should be able to live there legally, but they just can't. And then they have to inconveniently hide all their stuff, but there's space for them. And then, of course, there's some that are just, like, crammed in, and that wouldn't be legal in California either if you have, like, 12 students in a really small house. But in some of these with just 6 or 7 students, they're just being sneaky. Like, the person, one of the people I interviewed in the article, he has to hide his mattress, which is, like, pretty common. So either, like, throwing like boxes over and make it look like a random like storage space to the side, or putting it in the garage, or just like standing it upright, or some people even like break down their beds if they have wire bed frames that can condense, just anything their landlord comes to check to hide their existence basically.
And you spoke with a lawyer for this story. What did he say?
Yeah, so I spoke with John Fricks, and he was basically just saying that if this was challenged, he has pretty good evidence to believe that it'd be found illegal in the city. But the problem is, it's really doubtful that anyone will challenge it.
That's my next question. Do we see a lawsuit in San Luis Obispo's future?
I would really doubt that anyone would bring this to the city, because right now the landlords are already getting their money. I mean, students get it to them maybe through illegal means with this off-lease living situations, but they're still getting the money, and landlords don't want to go through the legal fees of, like, what purpose would that serve them? And then students aren't really going to want to take time out their schedule to, like, challenge the city on this ordinance.
So you're saying landlords know about this and just sort of turning a blind eye to it?
Yeah, I spoke to a few landlords, and they all could tell that the ordinance was kind of questionable, but they're going to follow it because they don't want to have violation fees from the city if they're found out.
Are there any other communities that have this sort of off-lease situation going on?
I would assume that a lot of college towns have students living off-lease, just because, I mean, no matter what rent is, if you can add more people to split it, it'll be cheaper. But SLO definitely has, like, a very restrictive occupancy ordinance for homes, which I think increases the amount of students and just people living off-lease.
And so you spoke with someone highly involved in the city, Heidi Harmon. What did she say?
Yeah, so Mayor Harmon calls this ordinance more of a guidepost, and one of the big things that she mentioned and kind of stressed when I spoke to her was that she didn't think it caused any harm. And I think that's kind of the city stance on it. So maybe it's not illegal, but what harm does it do? And I really wanted my article to show, yeah, this was put in place 30 years ago. Maybe it doesn't seem like a big deal, but for some of these students, it affects them every day in their own homes.
And, you know, this goes to my last question here. We know that San Luis Obispo is an expensive place to live, and we've even heard stories about students living in their cars. What do you think can be done or is being done to help make it easier on students to get a roof over their head in San Luis Obispo?
That's hard. It's just, I don't think anything very significant is happening, but you can try different home sharing situations. There are legal ways to try to cut costs. But I think taking down this ordinance would be a good start. I just don't know if the city will do it.
Ashley Layden, reporter at Cal Poly media outlet Mustang News. You can read her articles online at mustangnews.net. Ashley, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. It's been 100 years since San Luis Obispo County set up its first public library, and this year, the SLO library system is celebrating. In digging through the archives for centennial material, staff came across a wrong that they needed righting. San Luis Obispo's first city librarian is buried in a local cemetery with no grave marker. So staff and volunteers started a GoFundMe campaign to raise the money to buy a headstone for Frances Margaret Milne. They've since surpassed their goal. The headstone has been delivered and is awaiting installation. Library officials are planning a memorial and dedication ceremony in April. KCBX's Greta Marr recently headed to San Luis Obispo's San Luis Cemetery with SLO Library's Sharon Coronado to learn a bit of local library history.
This right here?
This would be her here. This is her husband and mother.
So tell me all about it. Who is this woman? What are you guys doing?
So this is Frances Margaret Milne, and she was the first City of San Luis Obispo librarian. And we have buried with her is her mother, who she took care of, and her husband, who she took care of. And as you can see, they both have beloved stones that were thoughtfully installed for them. And Frances Margaret passed away and she had no children, and we don't know why she doesn't have a grave marker. It's just that when we were doing some digging for our centennial, we learned that she didn't have a grave marker, and we just knew it was something that we would be able to take care of. And so the foundation for the library started a GoFundMe campaign, and that last we looked, we were looking for $1,500, and we were just $60 shy of that. So we're almost to our goal.
Interesting. All right, so her husband was, it says, James Proven Milne, mm-hmm. Native of Edinburgh, Scotland. Mm-hmm. Can you just read the rest for us?
James Proven Milne, native of Edinburgh, Scotland, at rest, May 11th, 1894, inscribed to his dear memory by his fondly loved and sorrowing wife, Remember, his heart was the temple of truth.
Well, that's nice. Mm-hmm. And so she must have made that one.
Right.
Right? And then what does the mother say?
Frances Margaret, beloved wife of Isaac W. Tenner, June 10, 1805 to November 21st, 1897, 88 beautiful years and now abideth faith, hope, love.
Wow, yeah, she had a pretty long life. And do you know where she came from?
From Ireland, yes. Frances Margaret emigrated with her family from County Tyrone, which is in Northern Ireland.
Okay.
So she was born June 30th, 1846. And the family, when Frances Margaret was 3 years old, emigrated to America in 1849.
Okay, and I wonder how she came out to be up in San Luis Obispo.
So I don't know the exact reason they came here, but when she was in her early 20s, her family came, and then she met her husband here and got married in California.
Okay.
And she was a writer, and she still has the University of California, is still printing her book. So she was a famous person. She made a name for herself, but if you came here, you wouldn't find her name.
Right, exactly. It's just grass. What is her book?
She wrote a lot about the single tax movement, and she was really interested in people living in poverty and how, as a society, we could change that. She was the first City of San Luis Obispo public librarian from November 1899 until 1910 when she was sick.
Okay. What was she instrumental in doing?
So her obituary says that she was beloved by the community and that she served everyone equally, no matter their position in society. So there is a difference between the City of San Luis Obispo Library and the county. The county came much later.
Ah.
But we're still honoring her because we just felt like, why should anybody not have a grave marker? So that's why we got involved with it. She wasn't officially part of the county at all, but she's still one of us, so Semper Fi.
Okay, right. And so tell me about your, what is this all, it's kind of part of the 100-year celebration? Or
well, we don't want this to be any kind of publicity stunt or fanfare or anything like that. We are happy that people are donating and we're supported in our efforts, but we're just want to do it just for her so that people can find her. When you are celebrating your past and you're looking through things and you realize you need to also preserve your future, this is part of that.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. In addition to the library's 100th anniversary, this week is also the 40th anniversary of the Slow Friends of the Library annual book sale, one of their biggest fundraisers. That's scheduled March 7th through the 9th, and will be at the Veterans Memorial Building on Grand Avenue in San Luis Obispo. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. We're excited to bring you a two-part series on diversity and inclusion at a major university on the Central Coast, Cal Poly. It's been in the spotlight for several years after racist incidents highlighted the need for more awareness of diversity and inclusion on the campus. This year, an associate dean in Cal Poly's College of Science and Mathematics was recognized by the university at a big event hosting the American philosopher, political activist, and social critic Cornel West. Camille O'Brien has been a strong advocate of inclusion and equity efforts for underrepresented students and was the inaugural recipient of the Campus Martin Luther King Legacy Award. Camille sat down with me in the KCBX studios for a lengthy discussion about race, diversity, and inclusion at the university. We'll be airing this in two parts this week and next, and it will be available on the KCBX website. We begin by letting Camille introduce herself.
My name is Camille O'Brien, and I am a professor in the kinesiology department at Cal Poly and one of the associate deans in the College of Science and Mathematics.
Kinesiology falls under the realm of mathematics, is that?
Yeah, it's kind of strange. Actually, recently our department name changed to Kinesiology and Public Health, so I keep forgetting that. But about, I guess, 22 or 3 years ago, the department moved into the College of Science and Math during a budget cut in the Cal State system. They used to be in the College of what was called Professional Studies.
And you've been with the university for a minute.
A minute, yeah, since 1999. Yes, indeed. So coming up on 20 years.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Tell me a little bit about your background. Where do you come from? Where did you grow up?
Oh, okay. So promise me you won't hate me. I grew up in Boston. Go Patriots.
I'm a Saints fan.
Oh,
so
I know. They got robbed.
I'm extra bitter this year.
I'm sorry. That was bad. Should have been the Saints and the Patriots.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
I think it would have been a more fun game.
I think so. Maybe higher scoring.
Exactly.
But I grew up in Boston and went to the Boston Public Schools. And then I went on to Smith College for my undergrad degree, where I majored in French, and got my master's degree also from Smith in exercise and sports studies. And after a couple of years of teaching and working in various roles, I went off to Ohio State, the Ohio State University, and got my PhD there. Okay. And now I'm in California.
And what brought you out to the Central Coast?
Really, the job at Cal Poly. That was it. You know, I was a professor, as assistant professor at Ohio State, and looking for an opportunity to do more teaching, because Ohio State's much more published and research-oriented. Not that that's a bad thing, but I really saw the opportunity at Cal Poly to work more with undergraduates, which was very appealing. So I applied, and here I am.
And what's so appealing about working with undergraduates?
They are, especially at Cal Poly, they're more curious, and maybe the chance to really mold and shape folks. Not that I feel all omnipotent, but I used to coach and swimming. And so what I see with teaching and working with undergraduates is that sort of thirst and hunger and just curiosity that sometimes isn't as evident in doctoral students or, you know, master's programs, or if you're just doing research and not always, you know, engaging with people and learning and growing and watching growth be so grand. So that was what's appealing to me.
It's also a really, you know, exploratory time in many of these students' lives, especially if they're coming right out of high school or whatever. Oh. So there's so many feelings and learning and changing. And
yes, that's correct. I mean, that's the 18 and overs, 18 to 24s. And even if they're not traditional age, yeah, there's just the world is people's oyster. And sometimes it can get really confusing. So to have a chance to help people navigate that helps me stay young, helps me grow, which is exciting.
Great. Well, recently you were the inaugural recipient of the Campus MLK Award that salutes a campus community member who upholds the legacy of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. by leading with love and hope to create a legacy of diversity, equity, and inclusion. So
I know, right?
How did that feel to win that award?
I was and still am so shocked and so I can't believe it. You know, when Brian Hubane was reading the announcement about it and describing the award and the purpose of the award, in my head I was thinking about all the people at Cal Poly since I've been there, or the people even before I came out to California, who have shaped and molded me. And, you know, growing up in the 60s and 70s in Boston and sort of living through some of the things I lived through in my life, I thought, wow, this is going to go to somebody really special. And I could think of a million other people other than me. And then he said my name, and my legs gave out on me. I really, literally couldn't believe it. I just might even get a little emotional now, because people have been so supportive and kind and their expressions, and it means so much to have this recognition.
Well, congratulations. And this was at the Martin Luther King dinner, and yes. Cornel West came in and he spoke. I was there, yes. And when your name was called, there was a resounding applause and cheers from students in there. So you've clearly had an impact on a lot of people at the university. Looking at your resume, I mean, it seems no surprise that you would win this award.
You've
really been a champion for diversity at Cal Poly and inclusion, correct?
Yes, I would say so. And it kind of comes naturally to me. I mean, it's so like I know I'm where I am because of other champions for diversity and inclusion. And it's just how it's kind of in my bone marrow and my DNA to do the kind of things I've had the chance to do. And especially, you know, to be a voice and supporter of students and faculty and staff and myself helps us all be better and feel like opportunity is just there. So it was... I'm very touched and very excited.
Who are some of the people that helped shape you in this journey?
Oh, my gosh. Where do I start? My family is really first and foremost in my mind, the people that have shaped me. I come from a very large extended family and a pretty multiracial, multi-ethnic, very diverse family. And thinking back on times, like at Thanksgiving or at holiday times, you know, multiple religious views and beliefs. There was never any shortage of interesting conversation around the dining room table. And my father and his twin brother were the first African Americans to earn their master's in business administration at Northeastern in 1964. And I remember they had took a picture of, you know, my father and his twin, and then my mom and my aunt and us as kids. And, you know, that was in the Boston Globe, and just always surrounded by a lot of firsts. And my Uncle John O'Brien, was the first African-American elected to the Boston School Committee in an at-large city election, which was pretty huge in the 1970s because it was on the heels of a court-ordered desegregation of the Boston public schools and busing. And, you know, so kind of growing up amidst all that tension, but also seeing that even through all the tensions around race and divisiveness, that communities could come together, you know. And so I saw a lot of advocates and activism as a child, which kind of rubbed off on me and sort of, you know, like I said, comes as second nature into my bone marrow to keep aware and be involved in, you know, trying to make sure that we're all be included.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you are chair of the Inclusion and Equity Committee, which looks into policies and practices that are barriers to student success.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that committee?
Right. So this committee for inclusion and equity is actually, the one I chair is a college committee. And so in the spring quarter of 2018, talking with Dean, our dean's name is Dean Wendt. So talking with Dean.
And this is in the College of Science and Mathematics, correct?
That's correct. So there was some talk about needing and wanting a college-wide committee. Some departments had already started to create committees in the college. We got together a group of volunteers during the spring quarter of 2018 and started visioning, coming up with a vision, a mission, some objectives we want to accomplish. And so we have six objectives right now, still evolving. And the idea around looking at the policies that could serve as barriers to success, we right now at the point of coming up with task forces, right? So we're going to have a student success task force. We'll hopefully have a faculty success task force and a staff success task force. And so baby steps at first. I think we kind of know what some of those barriers are. Typically, it's finances. A lot of students who are underrepresented have, you know, financial limitations, challenges, barriers. Sometimes it's sort of the internalized stereotype threat. You know, some students, I just think of myself as a student. I can't put my words into another student's mouth. But I know for me growing up and coming through college and even graduate school and even as a professor, sometimes it's easy to feel like I'm not as good as somebody else because of internalized feelings around racism or sexism, those kind of things. So working with a lot of mentors and things, I realize, no, the reality is I do deserve to be here. And so, but I see that in students a lot of times, they self-doubt and sort of like sometimes in self-loathing, like they just don't feel like they're worthy to be at Cal Poly. And it's heartbreaking to see somebody already setting themselves up for failure before they have even tried. And it gets impacted more so when people make like insensitive remarks or and trying to think that they're trying to help somebody, a faculty member or a staff member can inadvertently demoralize a person and even though they're trying to help. A lot of us can't help ourselves, you know. It takes a lot of time and energy and awareness to even know our own biases, you know, and how they are, we use them so subconsciously or unconsciously, implicit bias, right? And it takes a long time to sort of become aware of those implicit biases and how they manifest themselves and what we say and what we do, what I say, what I do. I'll speak for myself again. I see it over and over again. People lose themselves, right, in the process of trying to fit in. So my last name's O'Brien, right? So growing up with a last name that looks and sounds Irish with brown skin in the city of Boston was sometimes troubling because people would assume I was white. And then they'd see me and I could literally see them just be taken aback like, oh, they'd say, you're black, right? Or African-American or whatever, depending on what year or generation I'm in. Because over my own lifetime, I've gone from being colored to Negro to African-American to Afro-American. So our labels shift and change, our identities, you know, and how we kind of see ourselves or how other people see ourselves in the world. So I could definitely, you know, see where color blindness can sometimes lead to problems. And I want to try to encourage us to be conscious, color, race, ethnicity, gender conscious, not blind.
Just joining us, you're tuned to KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Tyler Pratt, and I'm speaking with Cal Poly Professor and Associate Dean Camille O'Brien, an advocate for better inclusion for underrepresented students on campus. Let's return to that conversation.
What do I hear from students who are underrepresented coming to Cal Poly? I think I hear a lot of the same things I experience as a person of color. You know, where are more people that look like me? Faculty and staff don't really understand what my needs are. There is no way to get my hair cut, you know, products. You know, do you know a barber or a hairstylist in town that can do braids or, you know, like the smallest things, like just in terms of your own comportment and feeling, you know, like you've got a place or a space. And so I think what I've found myself doing around diversity and inclusion issues is, again, starting always by listening, sharing a little bit about my story. I came to Cal Poly in 1999. I was, at the time, the only African-American faculty member in the College of Science and Mathematics, so the whole college, and, of course, the only African-American person in my department. And that wasn't anything unusual. I mean, this is nothing unusual. I've had this experience before in higher ed. But it did become more and more overwhelming to me to be out here 3,000 miles away from my family. Most of my mentors and advisors are still like Ohio or, you know, points east. And so my transition to Cal Poly was not smooth. Teaching was going well. I got along well with my faculty colleagues, but there were a few instances on campus or in the local community where I just felt othered or disrespected. And it just, even though things were going well, it just became too much. And you know, my mother was having some health problems, so I thought maybe it's time to leave. Always sort of having to overcome those like little, you've heard of microaggressions, right? So just hearing it constantly in faculty meetings or in one-on-one conversations or walking around campus, nobody explicitly saying anything mean and nasty. Well, I was called the N-word a few times, you know, just in the local community. I was exhausted. So I started looking and was able to get another job and was offered a position at University of Tennessee, Knoxville. And I took a leave of absence and I left. I packed up. I sold my house. I'm gone in 2003. Didn't think I'd ever look back. And the grass isn't always greener, right? You know, I had some good friends and colleagues there and also at Vanderbilt. So I felt very supported and welcome in that department and program. Again, it was a chance to work with doctoral students, which had a lot of similar interests to me in what I was studying. And that was exciting. It was fun. But you know what I missed most of all? The students. Cal Poly students. I missed their commitment to their education. I missed their intellectual curiosity at the undergraduate level. I felt like they were much more willing to engage with me and engaging in the same kind of courses I was teaching. Whereas, you know, Eastern Tennessee, not so much. You know, now the undergrads in my classes at Cal Poly, you know, you'd go to the beginning of the course, you'd talk about the syllabus, you'd lay out the plan, you'd start having your classes and things, and students right off the bat were like, you know, how I want to learn more. What can I do? Here's something I read that sounds like we were talking about in class the other day. I thought you might be interested. You know, there was this really two-way street between me and the students at Cal Poly. Still is, right? And at University of Tennessee, Knoxville, it was much more like pulling very impacted wisdom teeth. Now, the institution, lovely institution, but I was glad I took a leave of absence. And after 1 year, I returned to Cal Poly. And when I came back, I said, you know what? I'm not going to let what I feel is a losing battle around feeling welcome. I'm going to be more of a partner with folks on campus to help me feel welcome and help others like me feel welcome. And that's when I started getting more involved in campus organizations, campus governance. The rest is history, as they say.
You know, I've heard this in my reporting with students on campus that Cal Poly offers some of these programs that are the only ones on the West Coast for these science and engineering and aerospace mm-hmm. programs, and you get some of the best and the brightest out here. And so it draws a student population that really cares about their education. Mm-hmm. And in talking to underrepresented students out here, they felt really thrust into the spotlight, say last year when a lot of the awful racist things were happening on campus, and thought it was unfair. I'm here to go to class. I'm here to learn. And now I've been thrust into a spotlight about mm-hmm. how do I feel mm-hmm. about all this, say the blackface incident.
Yes.
When I'm trying to pass my test and go on to the next term.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I think that that's kind of not just at Cal Poly, but everywhere around the world. And especially in higher education, you know, people of color, we don't need to be the ones like helping to teach others about racism or sexism or the way these things intersect, right? I think it's on everybody's responsibility to educate themselves and increase their awareness. And I think that does exhaust people to kind of constantly be put in the taxism. It's just called cultural taxation is a phrase I've heard before. This expectation that the students who are the targets of the nasty, oppressive, racist, whatever behavior are the ones that try to help make everybody feel better, or that they're the ones that have to be continually asked how do they feel or how's this impacting them. It's like I'd rather look at the institution and say, what could we do differently to educate and all of us about, you know, diversity and inclusion? But and then when people sort of, you know, push the boundaries or step out of line, you know, how do we create policies or practices to try to help us educate, discipline as necessary, if necessary, you know, people who are, you know, violating the rules of the campus or the policies, you know. And it gets really tricky really quickly because you sort of can be encumbered. We can be impacted by or encumbered by the tension around freedom of expression and hateful expression or outside sources or the social media. So it's very, very complicated, right? So I feel like our students, what I really, really appreciate about our student community at Cal Poly is their level of activism. And in 2008, when we had the incident at the Crops House, there was a house in one of the College of Agriculture, Food, and Environmental Sciences has, you know, students who live and learn by doing in the different places where they grow fruits, vegetables, whatnot. And so apparently I wasn't there, but there was a party at one of these houses, and around Halloween time, the students or people involved hung up a noose and a sign that said no in words and F words, derogatory term towards gay people or hippies allowed. And this is sort of like early days of social media, right? And the students came together within 24 hours across all different types of identities, social identities, cultural identities, and they had a protest in the University Union Plaza. You know, hate is not a Cal Poly value. And a bunch of my colleagues and I stood in solidarity with the students as they called themselves to action and wanted to hold each other and the institution accountable for, you know, creating an environment where folks didn't have to see these images or hear these words that made it very clear that you're not welcome here. You know, when it says no so-and-so allowed, right? Not hard to interpret that as you're not welcome here, at least in my mind. There was President Baker at the time did host a forum, a community forum, and allowed time for people to ask questions. And this was in the early days of Cal Poly's adoption of the inclusive excellence model from the American Association of Colleges and Universities. So inclusive excellence is kind of a way of being, a way of doing, thinking about how to set up your institution where everybody can be excellent because they're included. And it can manifest its way in itself in a lot of different ways, and through curriculum, through programs, practices, policies, whatever the case might be. So I think it was kind of good that we were just kind of really beginning as an institution to look at diversity more deeply and not just counting like how many white, how many black, how many old, how many young, how many Pell eligible, financial aid, whatever. We were looking at campus climate issues.
Well, let's talk about some of the initiatives that you've launched on campus, this Love, Empathy, and Respect campaign.
So Love, Empathy, Respect. So that wasn't just me. I just want to start off there. It began 2017, January. Mayor Yiannopoulos is coming to campus. So again, a lot of activism around that. Many faculty, staff, and students are sort of trying to encourage Cal Poly not to allow him to speak. He came. There was a lot of money and time and energy spent on protecting the campus and people from any possible riots and whatnot. There's also sort of this uptick in flyering posters around campus on in academic buildings, on bulletin boards, with really derogatory statements and comments against queer people, against Barack Obama, and calls for, you know, people to engage in white supremacy. So this is happening, like all this, you know, flyering is happening around campus. We also had the free speech wall that was erected on Dexter Lawn, which is on campus. People would write very, very hateful, I don't even remember all, just nasty, hateful, insensitive comments about people based on different social and cultural identities, whether they're lesbian, gay, bisexual, or black, or immigrants, you know. It just was really bad. And faculty and staff were starting to talk to each other. We're concerned for the welfare of our students. We were like, well, what do we value? You know, what? How can we have a way to express our values and show students that we care and that we're glad that they're here and we want everybody to feel welcome and have a chance to be successful? I mean, college isn't supposed to be easy. I mean, it's going to challenge us intellectually. It's going to push us. But at the same time, it shouldn't be filled with this chronic, you know, attacks on our identity. And so that's where the love, empathy, respect came up. Those are our three values. A student, graphic design student, designed like you see the logo and images on badges or stickers, magnets, buttons, posters. We had a couple of pop-up events over the last few quarters where we just will show up with a table and just give out the buttons and stickers and magnets to students and talk to them. It's a visible campaign for inclusion. We've had a lot of support, not just at Cal Poly, but in the local community. I was at Food Fest the other day and I had my button on and was talking to someone else shopping in the Food Fest up in Atascadero, and I told him the same story and I had a couple of buttons in my pocket, so I gave him a button. He works at Atascadero State Hospital. So I've given buttons to people at Dunkin' Donuts in Massachusetts because I think people can get behind that. The hashtag is Mustangs United, right? And we're united around the values of love, empathy, and respect. And while I might not be able to freeze someone's speech, if they have the right to express their values, so don't I. And so these are the values that I choose to express. And we find them counter to some of the hateful expression that's happening. And I think it's been a nice way to, you know, rally around a message of inclusion.
You're tuned to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. That was part one of my conversation with Cal Poly Associate Dean Camille O'Brien about diversity and inclusion at Cal Poly. We'll air part two next week, where she discusses efforts she brings into her own classroom, as well as faculty diversity at the school. The full interview will be available on kcbx.org. We're going to take a short break, and then when we return, Father Ian Dellinger will be playing with food. Stay with us.
This is KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. The San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce isn't actually in the business of producing or preparing or providing food, but many of their members are. But there's a link, I promise. Consider this from their CEO, Jim D'Antona.
For more than 112 years, the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce has been dedicated to serving our membership through work to enhance the economic prosperity and community well-being of San Luis Obispo County. Our focus is on creating the best possible environment for people to live, raise their family, and pursue their passions in the place they love. Our chamber is the oldest and largest voluntary organization in San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties.
We all know that food production is a large part of the economic prosperity and community well-being of the Central Coast. One person invited me to pursue her passion for food, and that was former CEO of the Chamber of Commerce, Ermina Karim, who finished her tenure in the summer of 2018. I knew Ermina must be a great cook, and her story was one I wanted to hear and share. How did a family get from Bangladesh to Illinois and their daughter end up as CEO of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce? In this area that doesn't quite have the diversity that many associate with California, what happens when food is involved? And how did her time at the chamber help a Bengali girl from Illinois fit in? So in her kitchen, our conversation spanned from Bengali spices in Illinois to diversity and where to find it, to the power of sharing food, as I was playing with food with Ermina Karim.
Ermina Karim, I'm the former CEO of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. We are cooking two traditional Bengali dishes. One is dal, or lentils, and then kind of a eggplant curry dish. So my family, both my parents, are from Bangladesh, which is next door to India, former part of India. This is the cooking that I grew up on. I don't actually cook it myself, so you're in for a treat, but it feels like home for me. So I thought it'd be fun to cook a little bit Bengali food. We've got some, the long kind of Chinese eggplants that are cubed and they've been soaking a little water. I'm going to drain them out right now. And then I've got some red lentils that have been soaking that kind of softens them up for cooking. Okay, so these are the base of most Indian and Bengali cooking. If you have these, you're set. So I've got some coriander. We'll have some fresh later to finish, you know, cilantro. We've got some fried cumin powder. We actually grind it and fry it ourselves. Turmeric, red chili flakes, some red pepper, bok choy, which is a five spice mix. So you can see and smell what this smells like.
Oh, that's nice. It smells like walking into an Indian grocery store.
Right, all in one little jar. And so we'll have that in the eggplant. And then I made a little garlic paste. Ginger, some jalapeno. That's pretty much it. I got some chopped onions. So we'll just lay it on the base, get the things moving, and then we can keep the conversation rolling.
Okay.
Does that
okay.
sound good?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay. So I'm going to drain these right now first. Generally, there's a lot of similar spices used, but then how they come together or the additional details around really reflects the colonialism, you know, kind of who settled where. And the further south you go, the hotter the food gets, kind of typical of, actually, I mean, I think that's typical around the world. The hotter the place, the hotter the food. I mean, it's a lot of spice, but people correlate spice and heat. And I would say that's not what you get in Bengali food. It's typically not very hot food, but very flavorful, I think. Let's put the dal on.
I noticed that you don't have what a lot of people from the subcontinent has, and that's the pressure cooker or the new...
Oh, I do have a pressure cooker because my mom insists on cooking with it, but I don't know how to cook with it, so I don't.
They
terrify me.
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
Yeah, they terrify me. So
I think they're going to explode. That's all I think. My mom used it when I was a kid.
Exactly.
I just think that's going to blow up.
There must be a whole generation of us that are terrified by it because that's exactly right. That's what I think as well.
Where's your mom coming from when she comes here?
Illinois.
So did you grow up in Illinois?
I did. Born and raised in Rockford, Illinois. They came because my father was coming to study and do his PhD. He was a Rhodes Scholar at a University of Wisconsin-Madison in the mid-60s. And my parents had been married already in Bangladesh, living there. They had this opportunity. And, you know, at that time, there was a lot of turmoil in Bangladesh. It wasn't formed yet as a country. They kind of separated Hindus and Muslims. British did this, actually. And so my parents were in East Pakistan, but the power was in West Pakistan. There was a lot of turmoil. They did not share a language. They didn't share any common borders. And culturally, they were distinct. During this backdrop of turmoil, a lot of the educated class was a brain drain and kind of came abroad for safety. And ultimately, there was, you know, civil war, and Bangladesh was formed in 1971. But this was the mid-60s. Many people were being arrested, you know, if they were intellectuals or if they were not happy with the way the government was going. It was a difficult time. Okay, so what's happening here is I'm going to get some onions going. Onions are the base of all food in general, but particularly in India. get a little onion cooking. So all I did is slice one small onion, fried in some oil here. And what's ironic about that is I don't actually like onions at all. If I was in out and about, I ask for everything to be without onion. I also love what we call is shura, which is the sauce of all foods in Indian food. Like if you have chicken with shura, it's the sauce that the chicken's sitting in. And typically the classic Bengali chicken shura, it is all onions that have broken down, and it's the most, plus spices, of course, which is such an amazing flavor to me.
So you're adding the spices in, and that's one of the things I've noticed about Indian food is that you fry the spices as well.
Exactly, as you're cooking. And some of these spices, as I mentioned, I think with the cumin, it was fried in advance as part of how it's ground and cooked. And then you typically are frying it to bring out the flavors along the way. So cook this for just a few minutes. And then we will be adding all the other yummy bits.
What was it like growing up in Illinois?
Well, my name wasn't Melissa or Jennifer, and I didn't look like anybody else for sure. You know, I obviously didn't know anything different. So I was born and raised in a town called Rockford, Illinois, which now has very ethnically diverse town. When I was growing up, there was kind of almost equally African-American and Caucasian population.
Okay.
When I was at school, I was definitely the only brown kid. We did have some family friends that lived there. They were all Pakistani. There were no kids in my school that looked like me. I think for Caucasian people, they saw me as very similar to them, and I'm not certain what that was based on. For my African-American friends, I was not Caucasian. And it was interesting because I'm not an extrovert, but I think that it did shape who I am as a person because, like, I was friends with everybody. And you kind of had to figure that out, you know, as you were different from everybody else. But everybody was different at some level. I always felt really at home there. So I'm adding to the dal that's boiling now cumin, coriander, red pepper, salt, and turmeric.
It's great. It's all pre-measured like a cooking show, like Hermina's cooking show.
There you go.
And you're using red lentils.
Exactly.
So they don't take all day.
They will not. And they've soaked, so they should take even less. I need to add ginger, which is my garlic, which is right here. So as I mentioned, I kind of made a garlic paste in advance, and that goes in really nicely with this. This goes well with some tomato paste, but I didn't have any tomato paste. So I'm going to add a little tomato nonetheless. We'll see how this works out. All right, I think we are good. And let this boil. So San Luis Obispo always recognizes what a great place to live here. Where I was raised, it had been a wealthy town much earlier. By the time I was growing up there, the manufacturing had died, and it was not a great place to live. In fact, it was last week on one of those worst places to live. It's the worst place to live in Illinois, according to the rankings. You know, you read those things and you think, gosh, that wasn't my perception of it. You grew up in a small town, super different than this kind of lifestyle, but, you know, you make community wherever you go. And so there were six families that were from Pakistan and our family. That little group, we would socialize every weekend. And it always felt like we had this amazing tight-knit community. All right, now I gotta focus on getting the spices in.
Okay.
Add a little turmeric. So this is for the eggplant. My family traveled a lot, so I feel very connected to Bangladesh. We grew up going every other summer for usually about 3 months, you know, when school would get out, and be back by Labor Day weekend. And so that had a big impact on me. So it wasn't just the six families that I was spending time with in Illinois. It was because I also had the opportunity to really fall into the culture where I was from. You know, this is the 70s and the 80s, long before there was the internet.
You're putting in the jalapeno whole.
I am. It's just for smell in this case. Okay. And the same thing is going to happen over here. I'm going to add it in there. And let's just see, did I get everything in? All right, we're waiting for the water to boil, which is about to do the second. And I'm going to cover it up. I'm going to turn it down, and then we'll just keep our eye on that. It's about 20 minutes of cooking, and then let's check on the dal. So that's nicely breaking down. Hopefully I put enough spice. And if I didn't, your listeners won't be able to see your face. Many Indian families eat Indian food every day.
And did you?
So no, we did not. Like maybe twice a week, but not every day at all. My mom cooked all kinds of food. You know, they were immigrants, so they didn't eat certain things. Like when I go out with friends and I hear some of their stories about what they grew up eating, like these crazy casserole things and things wrapped in things and Jell-O with stuff in it, like we didn't have any of that. But we had really good food. My mom cooked great food, but she would make whatever was on point, you know, at that time, the 70s and 80s. But a lot of Bengali food too. All right, so that's on its way. Maybe it's a little salt. Put one of these in now.
So you're putting a slit in the jalapeno?
Yeah, I'm gonna put it in, but I'm not gonna empty it. I'm gonna add a little bit more water and keep that cooking. Do you like your dal thicker or lighter?
I've had it both ways. I prefer the traditional way.
Which is, what do you think that is?
Whatever the person.
Oh, okay. I'm like, but yeah. Both are traditional. Sometimes people will blend this, but I'm going to leave it like it is.
Okay.
Okay, sure. I'm going to make a little rice. I don't know if I'm going to make too much. Okay. So this is just a small vegetarian meal. Bengalis are not vegetarian. A typical Bengali meal is dal, bhat, which is rice, and fish, a simple fish. But that's the most common food. You know, you brought up a conversation earlier on diversity here, and I think, you know, we were on that piece that this area is much less diverse. And yet, Sunday, we were at Shalimar, and I was talking to the family there, and there's another Indian restaurant coming into where their former location was. You know, we were talking about the Taj Palace, and that family has had that restaurant successfully for a couple decades. And so on the surface, you don't see a lot. And then once my mom came here and she started finding some Indian friends, you know, you start to see there is community. There's all kinds of communities, not as visible socially in many settings, the small number as you started out with. But I think there is more than meets the eye, though. You know, I don't know what the opportunities are to keep celebrating that and bringing it forward. I mostly like to do the cooking. Okay. My husband helps. We both enjoy cooking. And so I think for both of us, cooking is an expression of love. I think he loves how much I love to cook. Because it's a form of relaxation, he knows that, like, okay, his form of relaxation, he likes vacuuming. I mean, he's got weird things.
You gotta find a partner
who can do that. Yeah, exactly. You know, so we're, you know, we balance each other out. That's nice.
Okay, so it's steamed a little bit.
Yep. We're gonna eventually boil off all this water because you don't want to have any of the water.
Okay.
It's cooking down.
The skin goes from purple to brown.
Yep. And it just gets more and more beautiful, in my opinion. Although these Chinese eggplants are just so perfect on the outside, a beautiful skin. So the dal is pretty much done. Then all we'll do to finish this off is what's called bagar. You fry onions in either butter or we have ghee. And I'm going to add a little ginger to it. And you fry that and you top and finish the dal with that. So that's all it is. So you can see dal is so simple. I haven't had to do anything. Onions in here. I think that when people connect over food, they're able to find more commonality. And you see them differently. That kind of connection of how you see people over food, just it changes the relationship. Okay, I gotta make some amendments here because this one needs a little bit more flavor. So I have never made this, and I took a recipe from my mother that is, well, you can see it. I'm quite certain she forgot her spice. That's the way she is. In fact, I called earlier today, I'm like, does it need this? Oh, yeah, you can add that. Okay, it feels like that's probably needed. I went down here. So we'll have to fix it, but I don't really know how to fix it, so I'm figuring it out. I'm gonna add some cumin. I am putting straight in my fried onions in the ghee and my fried ginger, and I am stirring that into the dal, which is nice and thick, and that will finish the dal. Okay, so is everything off here? It is. So we've got rice that will be ready.
And do you know there's an Indian mini mart in Santa Barbara?
The one that's in the neighborhood?
Yes.
We have been to it. It's pretty random, that place, which I love. It's so classically Indian there because it's like on the corner, on a random street. I love it. All right, I think that's done. I think this is going to be done. I'm going to let that cook down just a little further. Get some flavor in there. Can I pour you something to drink?
Sure.
Would you like water, bubbles? There's probably beer in the fridge.
Bubbles in my water would be fantastic.
Perfect.
Oh, you meant those types of bubbles. Fantastic.
Right?
I'm just thinking like sparkling water.
But... Oh, I have that too.
But you're like, this is more exciting.
No. It's already, it's 1 o'clock.
Okay.
Cheers.
Cheers. Do you think champagne goes with Indian food?
I do. I think champagne is one of the best food wines, period. I'm going to fry a little Boucheron separately.
See, you know what you're doing. You know that something's missing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's the important thing.
Yeah, the flavor's not quite right, but I don't know what it is. Okay, now let's add a little bit of ginger. I'm just going to add a small amount of everything. That and some Boucheron. I love cilantro, and I think that it makes everything better. So we're just picking off some leaves, and I'll chop it, and we'll have a little fresh cilantro for all of this food. Incredible. Are you okay with me putting a dal right on the rice?
Yes. Do it how you think it should be done.
Okay.
I want to experience how a true Bengali would eat this food.
A true Bengali eats with their hands.
Yes.
Do you know how to eat with your hands?
No, I do not.
Okay. You want to grab a seat? Do you want some lemon? I'm going to place it on your plate okay.
So what do we have here again?
Well, we've got basmati rice with some mushroom dal, which is the red dal, and some cilantro on top, and an eggplant curry dish, a little tomato relish, and some champagne.
Great.
The traditional food.
Is it Bengali champagne?
How did you know?
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to try this dal. It looks really good. I love how the pinkish red dal turns bright yellow. It's good. Good flavors. Very good flavors. And I like the texture. And here's the eggplant. It's good. I don't know why you'd say it had a few problems. It tastes fine.
It's not quite right. I'm not certain what's not right about it. I'm not going to kill you. It won't kill you.
It won't kill me. I think it's delicious. It tastes good with the chutney. But the chutney is basically...
Tomato.
A tomato relish.
Yeah. You know, I want to go back to the question you asked me before that I didn't answer, which was about the meaning of the chamber to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had 10 years of an experience that is unlike any that I'd ever had. It's such a phenomenal organization because it's one place, it's a microcosm of this community. It's a venue, it's a space, it's a community that allows people's ideas to flourish and to learn from one another. And there's a lot of diverse thinking within the organization as a whole, kind of a welcoming, connective space. And the chamber for me, when I started working there, is what made me feel like part of this community. I felt very out of place when I moved here. And those 10 years and that work has just changed my perspective on what people are able to do when they work together. So back to food. When I first became the CEO, that annual dinner, I decided the day of I was going to wear a sari, which is traditional Indian clothing. I wasn't certain how that was going to be received in this community because you don't see a lot of people wearing their own cultural clothing. And so I remember thinking, gosh, I'm going to be sending a message that this is like, here I am, here's my whole self, you know. And up until that point, thinking there's probably a look for the CEO or a behavior for the CEO. There's a set of behaviors that I need to adopt once I became in that role. And my husband always said, oh, just be yourself. You know, that's why you're in the job. And bringing it back to food, it really ended up being that way because when you are creating, we are all creating the culture and the community. And so you bring forward the things you love to who you are, maybe some of the parts of you that you don't show every day, but you want to bring forward. You bring it through your food and the way you connect and you create safe spaces. And so I will say that that's a lot of what I got out of being in this community at that chamber.
Thank you, Ermina, for forming a community with me in your kitchen and sharing who you are with your delicious Bengali food. For all you listening out there, share some food with others, find new commonalities, and feel your relationships change. That's the power of playing with food. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food.
You You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.